So I want to get through some of these slides, but we'll probably still adjourn early. This is the final chapter of the unit. And this one is about membrane structure and function, some of which we've talked about already, including what's shown here in slide one. What is this thing that's pictured here in the bottom center? This overall thing is what? It's a phospholipid bilayer, exactly. Meaning it's two layers of phospholipids. Each individual layer, one on the top, one on the bottom, is a monolayer. Two monolayers make a bilayer. And why does a phospholipid bilayer form automatically without any living thing involved?
Is it like since they bind together with the specific ends, and like, is it the pressure, I think it was?
Not pressure. What is it that's special about phospholipids chemically?
They're both hydrophobic.
Right. They are examples of things that have a hydrophobic part and a hydrophilic part. So before we go on, remember the correspondence of these words. Hydrophilic corresponds to what other word? Hydrophilic means water-loving. So that corresponds to what word as far as charge is concerned? Well, what kind of substance is water?
Polar.
Polar. Hydrophilic is polar. Hydrophilic things are hydrophilic, water-loving, because they themselves are polar. They don't mind being around fellow polar molecules like water. Hydrophobic, which is water-fearing, corresponds to non-polar. They are hydrophobic because they don't want to be around polar things, since they are themselves non-polar. Now, what do we call the overall molecule if it is part polar and part nonpolar? Phospholipids are examples of these. What word do we use to describe a phospholipid having this property? It's the word that means having dual preference. It's amphipathic. Phospholipids individually are amphipathic. In cartoon form, the head, the round part, is the hydrophilic part. What makes it hydrophilic? What's in the head? We've studied phospholipids. You don't see the detail here, but in the cartoon version, you don't. Right on the left, you don't. On the right, it's not labeled, but it's there. What is it about the head that makes it hydrophilic and therefore polar?
So the phosphorus has the same valence as carbon.
It's true that there's a phosphorus, which is an atom, but that's just one atom in the bigger functional group. What functional group has the phosphorus atom?
Phosphate.
So it's the phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms, right? And those oxygen atoms are ionized. That's what makes the phosphate group polar. And therefore, that's what makes each head of a phospholipid polar. That's the polar part, and therefore hydrophilic. The tails are what? What are the tails? I mean, as far as molecules are concerned, what are they? If they were on their own, what would they be called? Not quite, almost, and I was getting there next, but the complete tail, if it's by itself, before it's connected to the glycerol, what would it be called? It's the same kind of tail that you find three of in a fat. Well, the whole thing is a lipid once you're done constructing it.
Is it carboxyl?
There is a carboxyl in it, but the entire molecule, if it were on its own, is a fatty acid. All right? And you're right that at one end of the fatty acid is a carboxyl. That's what allows it to connect to the glycerol, whether you're building a fat when you use three fatty acids or a phospholipid, which uses only two fatty acids, and the third position is a phosphate. Okay? But anyway, you were jumping ahead correctly. If you ignore that carboxyl, the entire rest of the fatty acid is hydrocarbon. Nothing but carbons and hydrogens. And you're probably sick of hearing me say by now that hydrocarbons are nonpolar because carbon and hydrogen have about the same electronegativity and therefore share their electrons equally. That's what makes them nonpolar. So therefore, fatty acid tails are hydrophobic. They're nonpolar. They don't want to be around water. And this is why a bilayer will just automatically form if you have nothing but phospholipids in pure water. It's how the first cells started. So the monolayers are arranged with each other in a tail-to-tail manner. This is the only way that the tails can avoid being around water, right? The heads have no problem being around water, whether it's the exterior water or the interior water. And so this is a perfect arrangement. This is why life exists. But what you would form in that case, if it was just pure phospholipids, is called a micelle. It's not a living cell. But that's the precursor to the first cells that came into existence. The reason that you don't find a living cell with pure phospholipid bilayer is that a cell couldn't remain alive if you only had phospholipids involved. And that's because the phospholipid bilayer is selectively permeable, like we've talked about in lab. Certain things get through and other things don't. But some of the things that don't get through happen to be things that need to get either into or out of cells for the cell to remain alive. That's why a living cell's plasma membrane is more than just pure phospholipid bilayer. The phospholipid bilayer is the most important thing there. It's the substructure. But thrown into that mix are various other things, like we see in slide 2, including, importantly, various kinds of proteins. Proteins aren't the only other things besides phospholipids that are in a plasma membrane, but they are really important. So each of these purple things is a membrane-bound protein. Now, importantly, these proteins that are part of the membrane, they are not bonded to the phospholipids surrounding them. So what holds them in place? Well, that's what these labels are trying to explain. What holds the proteins in place is the fact that they contain polar regions and nonpolar regions as well. So think about polypeptides in general. A single polypeptide is one ribbon, right? One end-to-end arrangement of amino acids, which then gets folded up into some three-dimensional shape. But each individual amino acid has an R group, right? The variable part of an amino acid is the R group. We looked at the 20 biological amino acids and we grouped them together based on the similarities of their R groups, right? There was a nonpolar group. There are some amino acids that are nonpolar, some that are polar, and some that are beyond polar and charged. Okay, well, this, you don't see a ribbon here, but there is a ribbon. This thing is made of some sequence of amino acids, this protein is. And it's been folded now. But it's folded in such a way that this region happens to have amino acids with polar R groups, and so does this region. But the region in between those is made up of amino acids that have nonpolar R groups. That's what holds it in place. Because this nonpolar region doesn't want to be around polar things. If you imagine trying to poke this protein in either direction, trying to poke it into the cell or out of the cell, you could move it, but if you didn't go far enough and just let go, it would pop right back into place. Because moving this upward, let's say as an example, would mean that this hydrophobic region hydrophilic region, I'm sorry, would then be exposed when you push it upward to the hydrophobic part of the phospholipid. It doesn't want to be around that. Plus, you would expose this hydrophobic region to the heads that are hydrophilic. It doesn't want to do that either. So if you just push it a little bit and then let go, it would spring right back into place right here without being bonded to anything. That's what keeps them in place. Okay, in three, we see a phospholipid bilayer, but the two monolayers are being separated here by a special technique called freeze fracturing. If you get it cold, it makes it easier to separate these two. And the reason they're doing this is to try to find out which of the monolayers features more proteins. There's the extracellular layer, which is the outer surface, the outer monolayer, and the cytoplasmic layer, because that's the inside surface that's in contact with the cytoplasm inside the cell. And there are proteins associated with these, but when you actually separate the two monolayers, what you see in photomicrographs here to the right is that the cytoplasmic layer, the interior layer, is much more associated with proteins than the extracellular layers. Which makes sense because a lot of these membrane-bound proteins are there to interact with things that are in the cell in various processes. All right, four. Now it's time to introduce what is called the fluid mosaic model of membrane structure. So let's consider that phrase, fluid mosaic. Just the word mosaic first. Outside of biology, just in everyday language, what is a mosaic? Have you heard the word?
Like glass, like how you have like these like more random, I think, feeling splotches, kind of.
It's a work of art. A mosaic is an art piece, but rather than using paint to make the image, you glue little pieces like tiles or pieces of glass or whatever onto a surface, and they form the image collectively. That's a mosaic. Fluid means able to flow. In other words, it's changing shape. It's able to change shape. And that's a good descriptor of a plasma membrane, a fluid mosaic. The reason it's a mosaic, you don't really see it so much here because we're looking at the phospholipid bilayer on edge, right? But imagine being outside the cell and looking down at the top of the top monolayer here. You would see a bunch of polar heads, right? Just like if you were on a tall building looking down at a mass of people, you could see a bunch of heads. That's the mosaic aspect. Each one of those is like a little piece of the mosaic. Now, if it were an art piece, those would be glued in place. But we call it a fluid mosaic because just like a crowd of people, those heads don't stay in the same position, right? If you're looking down on Times Square at New Year's Eve, all the drunks are shuffling around throughout the night, right? So they're changing positions. And that's exactly what happens with the phospholayers, with the phospholipids within a monolayer. They're moving side to side, switching places with each other all the time. As a matter of fact, it's probably surprising to you how much that happens. This lateral movement within a monolayer happens about 10 million times per second. So the plasma membrane is just buzzing. It is very active. You also have a flip-flop shown here, which doesn't happen nearly as often. Much rarer event. A flip-flop is when a phospholipid of one monolayer switches positions with a phospholipid in the other monolayer. It should make sense to you that this is rare, because if you try to force this to happen, you're going to temporarily expose those heads to the tail region where they don't want to be. Right? This is for the same reason that the proteins stay embedded in there. The flip-flop is discouraged for that reason. But anyway, that fluid mosaic model is what describes the plasma membrane structure. And a plasma membrane, or a membrane in general, it also would apply to the membranes making up organelles. Any given cellular membrane can vary in its fluidity. In other words, how loose or how tight it is depends on conditions, including temperature, for instance. If the temperature gets high, that's going to loosen everything up. Well, fluidity is important, but you don't want too much fluidity. The membrane can get too loose. And correspondingly, you don't want it to get too tight either, which it would when it's cold, for instance. So cells have the capability to adjust the fluidity of the membranes in different conditions. Now here you have to think back to our discussion about fats, triglycerides, because that's when we first started talking about fatty acids. The tails of phospholipids are fatty acids just like they are in fats. It's just that there's two of them, right? But what I want you to remember is that a fatty acid can be either saturated or unsaturated, right? What makes a fatty acid saturated?
It always binds explicitly with hydrogen and not something else, right?
Close. It's that the carbon-carbon bonds in the chain are all single. There's no multiple bonds. And that allows those carbons, therefore, to hold the maximum number of hydrogens. That's why they're saturated with hydrogen. But no double bonds or triple bonds means that it's a nice straight chain. Okay? And therefore, they pack together tightly, making it more tight. So in response to increased temperature, when things would be getting too loose, the cell takes out some of its phospholipids that are unsaturated and therefore bent and replaces them with saturated fatty acid phospholipids, which pack together more tightly. But if it gets too cold, then the reverse would happen. You can put in phospholipids that have unsaturated bent fatty acids, and that makes it looser. Now, on the bottom, we see that animal plasma membranes, in addition to these phospholipids, feature cholesterol molecules. Cholesterol is an animal product. That's why I said this is animals doing this. And I've already told you one major reason why cholesterol is vital to us is the precursor to all the steroid hormones, right? But cholesterol is also an important animal membrane component. So it affects the fluidity, and how much is there affects the fluidity, and also it affects the permeability of the membrane to things like ions. Slide 5. I'll make this the last slide for today. Well, I just got done telling you about the fluid mosaic model. It's a nice model. It makes sense, but it's in science, you can't just make something up that makes sense. You have to demonstrate it. That's what this is all about. What they did to test the fluid mosaic model is to experiment. They started with two different cells, one from a mouse, one from a human. And not surprisingly, a mouse cell has some proteins that you don't find in humans and vice versa. So they needed a way to keep track of them, these things. They didn't actually color them magenta and purple, but they similarly labeled them. They chemically labeled the mouse proteins, and then they chemically labeled the human proteins so they could see where they're going. Then they fused the two cells together into a hybrid cell. Now, think about what would happen if the fluid mosaic model were not true. If it were not true, then they could come back later and they should still see the mouse proteins on one end and all the human proteins on the other end. But that's not what they saw. It didn't take long before it was a mixture of the two on all parts of the cell. So really what happens is each of the two types of proteins are diffusing, right? Each is going down its gradient till they're all mixed. But that shows you that the membrane is fluid, so it's a pretty good indication the fluid mosaic model is true. All right, let's stop there and we'll finish it up next time.